Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's give you a quick preview of today's huge show. First, a Debbie Collier update. Guess who wants cameras in the courtroom, along with a lot of motions that are filed in the Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell matters? The Eliza Fletcher autopsy has been released. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, aficionados. Thanks for watching. We have a huge show for you today, but you know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't, like if you do, leave me a comment, hit that bell so you get notifications when we go live or put up new content. And remember, you can listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Just simply search Crime Talk with Scott Reich. Okay, let's get to the docket. Let's go ahead and open the docket, I guess, for September 30th, 2022. First, Debbie Collier update. The Georgia police have described the Debbie Collier's mysterious death as personal and targeted as more evidence in the mom's demise emerges. Collier's body was found partially burned roughly 60 miles from her home in Athens, Georgia, on September 11th, a day after she sent a cryptic message to her daughter saying, quote, "They are not going to let me go. I love you." It is also said that investigators recovered Collier's purse and cell phone at the crime scene, which appeared to contradict earlier reports that she left her home with just her driver's license and a debit card. The sheriff has yet to name any suspects or leads in the case and has so far made no arrests. Meanwhile, a 911 call made by a woman who identified herself as Collier's sister has emerged detailing a prior encounter with an ex-convict. The call stated, "From my niece, she said Collier was in an accident about a month ago." Diane Shirley is heard telling a dispatcher on the call, and Shirley says her sister has been driving behind a truck when a paint can tumbled off of it and struck the vehicle. The paint went everywhere, and the driver was trying to convince my sister not to tell the cops he was driving because he was out on parole, and accordingly, he should not have been driving. Police confirmed that Ms. Collier had been involved in a minor traffic accident on April 30th, but additional information is still unavailable. In another 911 call on September 10th, Collier's husband, Stephen, tells a dispatcher his stepdaughter, Amanda Bearden, had found his wife's purse at their home. And he says, quote, "I came home. My wife wasn't home. Her driver's license still is there. The rental car is gone, and her daughter's here." He said this about 6 p.m. that day as he made the first official missing persons report. He said, quote, "We're kind of worried about what's happening and where she at. I was wondering if you could send somebody over here." Stephen continued, adding that his wife had no known medical issues. He also tells the dispatcher that he was out for most of the day parking cars at the football game. And according to her daughter, who went up and her purse is still here with her driver's license. The only thing is the phone is gone. And she sent her daughter a text about 2 hours ago saying, "They won't let me go." Whatever that means, we don't know. Now, Stephen's call contradicts information given on a missing persons report filed by Amanda on the same day, which stated she believed her mother did not take anything with her but her driver's license and a credit card. None of Debbie's family members have been named as a person of interest in the case. An officer said Friday they are still looking for suspects. And however, the investigators did note, "Right now, we have not ruled out anyone. We're still in the process of trying to find a person or persons of interest," the investigator said. "And we're still waiting data from several service providers regarding Debbie's recovered cell phones." He also said the police have confirmed Stephen was on video working from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. the day his wife vanished. Investigators are also waiting the results of Debbie's autopsy to determine exactly how she passed away. And earlier this week, surveillance video from a Family Dollar store in Clayton, Georgia, showed Debbie looking calm and shopping there for a blue tarp, a lighter, a tote bag, and a rain poncho a day before she was found dead. Now, Bearden and her live-in boyfriend, Andrew Giergrich, who both have a history of domestic violence allegations, have stated that they have been interrogated by detectives and have had their phones seized. That case is just getting a little more weird as it goes by. And, you know, now is it the ex-felon who dumped the can of paint off of a truck? Others, you know, we're not going to point fingers at anybody because, you know, we don't like to get sued. And everyone is given the presumption of innocence in all cases, unless and until they plead guilty or are found guilty by a jury of their peers. Next on the docket, guess who wants cameras in the courtroom? Well, I don't know what it is. Yesterday's show, we complain again about why it takes so long for the motions that have actually been filed and that the court is going to allow us mere unwashed out here to see the court file in the Vallow Daybell matters, that it takes 5 days for them to make it to the public. I don't know what the screening process entails. I really don't. But apparently the judge has decided that we can finally see what's been filed in this case. And it's getting good. So who do you think wants the case to be televised? That's right, Chad Daybell wants cameras in the courtroom during his trial, and he wants the proceedings live streamed for the public. John Pryor, Chad Daybell's attorneys, filed motions asking that Judge Boyce reconsider basically his previous ruling and consider the request of Mr. Daybell. It says that the defense has concerns that the lack of public access to the trial would cause financial hardship to members of the families. Because you have to remember, if the families of the defendant want to go to court, well, they have to foot the bill themselves, hotel, travel, food. If you're a family member of the victim in the particular case, that's usually covered through the victim's rights funds that are available to fly people back and forth to court, pay for their hotel, meals, lodging, everything along those lines. So yes, that could get expensive if family wants to do that. Mr. Pryor also cites family access and limiting the public from adequate access to what is a trial of great interest to the public. I totally agree. We want those cameras in there because, well, the public has a right to know. Anyway, it said that the defense would seek an opportunity to assert additional reasons for opening the proceedings to the public. As you may recall, obviously, Chad Daybell and his wife, Lori Vallow, have pled not guilty to all of these counts of conspiracy to commit the deaths of 7-year-old Joshua and 16-year-old Tylee, and the former wife of Chad Daybell, Tammy Daybell. Now, of course, this motion comes after Judge Boyce issued an order prohibiting cameras from Lori Vallow's hearings and trial, and the judge just sort of sua sponte, which simply means on his own, said that covers Chad Daybell as well. But there were no filings where Chad Daybell was even asked whether he wanted cameras in the courtroom at all. So go figure. Anyway, we got a lot of motions to talk about and some good points here. And it's kind of interesting because, hate to say it, but everything I've been saying, Mr. Pryor's been saying as to why there should be separate trials. So let's go through these motions. And some of them are lengthy, but I will give you the condensed version in simple, plain words so that everybody can understand them. Because, hey, that's what we're here to do. The first motion that was filed by Chad Daybell through his counsel was a motion to sever. Now, we've talked about several reasons why you want a motion to sever. And the most significant and most obvious is they're inconsistent theories of defenses, antagonistic theories of defenses. If you have two co-defendants that are charged with the same offense and they're pointing fingers at each other, guess what? That is an antagonistic defense. Now, I know the prosecution and the court only want to do this trial once, but guess what? You might as well do two trials now instead of doing two trials years later when the appellate courts reverse when there should have been a severance. Now, let's go through a couple of these items, all right? The first point that Chad Daybell makes in his motions are that a joint trial would deprive Mr. Daybell of his constitutional right to present a complete defense. And he puts in a bunch of stuff, but basically he gets to what I've been saying. It says, quote, Based on the allegations in this case, one of the plainly available defenses would be to demonstrate that Ms. Vallow and her brother, Alex Cox, were responsible for the crimes alleged and that they acted as part of their own conspiracy that did not involve Mr. Daybell. As part of the defense, Mr. Daybell would seek to introduce the prior bad acts of both Ms. Vallow and Mr. Cox, as well as evidence regarding their relationship and the death of Mr. Cox and the past statements of Mr. Cox. Ms. Vallow's prior bad acts would bear upon motive, intent, and plan. In particular, Ms. Vallow's alleged involvement in the murder of her ex-husband, who Mr. Cox told police that he had shot, plainly bears upon the issue of whether Ms. Vallow and Mr. Cox had an ongoing conspiracy that preceded the core of the alleged acts in this case. As such, Lori Vallow's previous conduct easily meets the relevant standard of reverse 404B. In fact, the information goes straight to the heart of Daybell's potential defenses. Now, the prosecution, when they file their response in this particular case, will say, guess what? We're going to bring all this information in anyway to show how everything came about, and it goes to show that there was in fact a conspiracy, that Chad Daybell was involved in it from the beginning. That's what the prosecution would argue. Chad Daybell is saying, no. As I've said, the defense would be simple. Alex Cox, Lori Vallow, they did the bad things. I had no idea. I was just a pawn in this entire thing. So we'll see how the prosecution will ultimately respond, but let's read on. Next, Mr. Pryor cites that a joint trial would create a conflict between Mr. Daybell's confrontation rights and Ms. Vallow's constitutional rights. Now, I got a little bit of heat early on, and because I kept referring to Lori Vallow as Lori Vallow, is not Lori Vallow Daybell. Have you noticed in these pleadings that Chad Daybell is referring to Lori Vallow as Lori Vallow, not Lori Vallow Daybell? I have. I think it's rather significant. I did that intentionally because, frankly, I didn't think it was going to work, and it's easier to distinguish everybody throughout these proceedings, and yet here it is. So just makes sense, doesn't it? All right. Create a conflict between Daybell's confrontation right. Really, what this is trying to say is this is a Bruton issue. All right. There was a case back in 1968, went to the United States Supreme Court. Two co-defendants were tried jointly, one of whom had made an extrajudicial confession that incriminated both his co-defendant and himself. Well, neither defendant testified on his own behalf, and the court admitted the confession into evidence but gave a limited instruction to the jury and said, basically, you can use it as to one defendant but not the other. Well, it made its way all the way to Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, you can't do that. So when there are Bruton issues, when there are statements that are going to come in that are admissible as to one but not the other, guess what? You get severance. Now, we don't know all of the statements that may have been made or can be interpreted as confessions, if there are any. We just don't know. But there must be something in the discovery where they're saying that you can't basically bring in statements that are incriminating as to one and not the other and expect a fair trial. Pretty good argument for severance along with the inconsistent defenses. And then Mr. Pryor basically says, hey, it's not fair if we get to the sentencing phase and we have the same jury. And frankly, that's the least of his concern. He should be trying to win his case. And then it basically says that severance is routinely granted in capital cases due to the need to have heightened reliability and other constitutional protections in a death penalty case. True, very true, very true. Why would you jeopardize it? I know the prosecution only wants to do the case once. Go do it twice, but do it right those two times. Bottom line, as you may recall, the court previously denied Chad Daybell's motion for severance because, frankly, it was a poorly written kind of boilerplate motion and didn't provide any specific examples other than, well, the case needs to be severed. So the court denied it and then joined the cases for trial in January, even though Chad Daybell previously requested a trial to go in sometime of October of 2023. Now I think the court has to reconsider, and the court is mentioned in this motion, basically saying that the court considered the wrong legal standard when they did their previous motion. So I think this one is going to get some play, and we shall see. You just never know. The next motion for the defense is on behalf of Chad Daybell, and he basically is filing a motion to continue. This is, once again, some 30-page motion in this particular case, and he basically says, hey, this is a death penalty case, and there are unique and rigorous standards applicable to a capital case that are not necessarily applicable in just your routine case, which is true. We've mentioned this before. When it is a death penalty case, the defendants get hyper due process because you're getting the ultimate sentence. You got to make sure you did it right. The gist of the 30-page motion is that Mr. Daybell, there are constitutional rights during these proceedings, all of which are dependent upon counsel having an adequate amount of time to prepare. The right to an individual sentencing proceeding, the right to expert assistance during all phases of the capital trial. Because this is a capital case, the defense counsel has a significant additional professional and ethical obligation in preparing for trial. And basically what it comes down to is he needs more time, that the voluminous discovery has limited him from doing the actual mitigation portion of this trial preparation. Because remember, normally when somebody goes to trial and you lose, you set it over for sentencing. They do the pre-sentence investigation report. You know, they tell you all the kinds of information about the defendant, where he grew up, his education, prior criminal history, family background, abuse, all those types of things. Well, when you do a death penalty case, if there's a conviction on the first degree murder, then they'll roll straight into it. So basically you have to prepare for trial, but then you're also preparing for if you lose. It is difficult. I used to have to do that in the military. You're thinking, no, I want to, I'm here to win the case, but yet I have to prepare for a sentencing, which you rolled straight into if your client was convicted. It is time consuming. And really, what does this boil down to? Hyper due process and a Sixth Amendment right to have effective assistance of counsel. And when the defense counsel says, judge, I'm not going to be effective. There's no way that I'm going to be ready to go during this time period. The judge pretty much has to grant that motion to continue because it's a 35C. It's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim almost guaranteed if the court does it. Now, as you remember, it's different when the defendant, like Lori Vallow, when she said, I'm not waiving my right to speedy trial, and her attorneys say, judge, I can't really do this, but I can't force her to waive it, so I'm going to do my best during that time period. But when the attorney is saying, I need more time, and the defendant is willing to give his attorney more time, then guess what? He's probably going to get that motion to continue granted. The next motion filed was a bill of particulars. Now, they've had previous bill of particulars filed, and they have been denied. But once again, Mr. Pryor is saying, hey, we don't know certain things about this case, even to this point, and the defense needs to know so that he can effectively prepare for trial. So let's take a look. Specifically, as it relates to count one, it says, the government has failed to identify indispensable parties, those being co-conspirators, as well as defining with particularity, using plain, concise, and definite statements of fact, dates, and events this alleged conspiracy occurred on or between. The language in the indictment describes sometime between October of 2018 and January of 2020. The government has failed to identify where within the 1,369 square mile area of Madison and Fremont counties this alleged conspiracy occurred, not to mention the quote elsewhere end quote language, which is alleged to have occurred, the defense assumes, somewhere within the state of Idaho. And really what a bill of particulars is saying, judge, we just don't know. You got to help us out. And the prosecution charged it, so have them say this as well. In count two, the government used the words concerned in the indictment. And as Mr. Pryor notes in his motion, that's not an element of the offense. It says the government states in the indictment that Both Chad DeBell and Lori Vallow were concerned in the commission of the aforementioned crime. While willful, deliberate, and premeditated are all mentioned in the elements of the crime of first-degree murder, the word concerned is noticeably absent in the statute. The defense requests clarification on that word. You put it in the indictment, you gotta have an explanation for it. You have to be able to say why it's there. Additionally, there is apparently mention in the indictment that states that Chad DeBell endorsed and espoused religious beliefs for the purpose of encouraging and or justifying the homicides of J.J. Vallow. The defense says, hey, we want a plain, concise, and definite statement outlining the specific facts the government is relying upon to support this allegation. The defense has seen nothing thus far that would support Chad DeBell's religious beliefs either encouraged or justified the homicide in any way. Now, the next motion that was filed by the defense in this particular case was filed on behalf of Lori Vallow, and it is a motion titled Motion to Prevent Death Qualification of the Jury or for Alternate Relief. Well, what the heck does that mean? When a jury is qualified as a death juror, jury and juror, they have to agree early on that they are willing to impose the final ultimate punishment if the government has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. If a potential juror states that they could not impose the death penalty or would not consider it in any way, they are dismissed from the jury panel. The reason being is you have to be able to consider all of the possible penalties, in this particular case, death. And if they're unwilling to do that, which means they're unwilling to follow the law. And if they can't follow the law, they can't be on the jury. This motion, I get what they're doing. They're filing this motion to create an appellate record. It should be and probably came from some sort of law review article saying what the law should be. And basically what they're saying is basically go ahead and allow jurors on the panel that don't believe that they could impose the death penalty. And therefore, because all of these academics have shown that people are more inclined to impose the death penalty if they're on a jury and they say that they can follow the law. Really, that's what it's, of course they are. And if there are people that say they won't impose the death penalty, then they're not gonna impose as much. Seems to make sense to me. But you have to be able to follow the law. In the alternative, what they're asking for, and this is kind of interesting, prevent any death qualification of the jury in this case, and in fact, mandate life qualification. Basically, say, judge, just take away the death penalty. Second, impanel two juries should a penalty phase become necessary. And in this scenario, the court would first impanel a non-death qualified jury to hear the trial on the merits and deliberate and render a verdict. Should this jury convict Ms. Vallow on her death eligible charge, a second jury panel would then be chosen to hear and render a verdict in the penalty phase. This would eliminate the merit phase biases inherent in death qualified juries, which the bias is that they're willing to impose the penalty, right? And that the court should prevent questioning during voir dire for the trial on the merits on how a prospective juror would vote at a possible penalty phase or any similar inquiry into the death penalty views. Chances of this happening are about slim to none, okay? The court has to follow the law. The court is not going to make some decision on their own that we're not going to have a death penalty case. Don't think the judge has that authority whatsoever. And impaneling more juries, really? You think the judge who's more concerned about getting this trial done than doing two trials is going to panel multiple juries? Not going to happen. Good appellate record. I get it. But it's more for law reviews and academics than reality in a courtroom. Sorry, that's just the way it is. Next on the docket, an Eliza Fletcher update. The autopsy has been released. Now, according to an autopsy report, released yesterday, Eliza Fletcher died due to a gunshot wound to the back of the head and a blunt force injury to the head. Her manner of death was judged as a homicide by a forensic pathologist with the West Tennessee Regional Forensic Center, and the report is dated September 27th of 2022. As you may recall, Ms. Fletcher was out for a run near the University of Memphis on the morning of September 2nd when she was allegedly confronted, kidnapped, and killed. Her body was found on September 5th outside an abandoned house in South Memphis. A shell casing was found at the scene, according to the autopsy report. The report also said that Ms. Fletcher had bruises on her right thigh and her leg. She also had extensive facial injuries. It described a fracture to the upper part of her face. And interestingly, the toxicology report notes that there was fentanyl in her system. However, the report did not say how long the fentanyl had been in Ms. Fletcher's body or if she had, in fact, been sexually assaulted. For a woman out training for a marathon that early in the morning, somehow don't think that the fentanyl got into her system voluntarily. Just saying. Cleotha Abston Henderson is charged with the abduction and the homicide of the Memphis mother and teacher. Obviously, we'll give him the presumption of innocence, but it's not looking good for him. Next on the docket, finally, our dumb criminal of the day. You can see the bandit made off with a truck parked near a Nebraska pet control company, eventually only to find out that the rig was loaded with hundreds of pounds of bat poop. That's right. The thief is shown driving away the 14-foot trailer of 500 to 700 pounds of bat feces in the parking lot of the Borland Wildlife Solutions, which is located in Lincoln, Nebraska. The trailer and the equipment and the 700 pounds of the bat dung, according to the company, they remove the disease-carrying critters' droppings from the attics of local homes with a vacuum before hauling it away in bags. Now, the thief probably assumed that the rig was full of expensive equipment, and the crook is still at large with the trailer and the bat dung, and the trailer's worth $15,000. No report as to the value of the bat dung. Anyway, can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, want to thank you all for watching. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We will see you next time on Crime Talk.